At Greg's Pump and Well Service, we believe integrity is the cornerstone of everything we do. This month, we proudly salute our armed forces and first responders, those who embody true service, dedication, and integrity. When you choose us for your pump and well needs, you're choosing a company that shares those same values. Thank you for your service. Let us serve you with pride. 530-282-5395. Call us at 530-282-5395, license 109-0355.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
If you're required to hire people for requirements other than their qualifications, their merits, then you're going to end up with a board that really is not very effective in running the business. So it can be very damaging to your company.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Andy Puzder, attorney, author, and businessman, former chief executive officer of CKE Restaurants, which includes Hardee's and Carl's Jr. He's also the author of a brand new book, A Tyranny for the Good of Its Victims, The Ugly Truth About Stakeholder Capitalism. We go in depth with Andy Puzder about that book here today. Andy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The new book is A Tyranny for the Good of Its Victims, The Ugly Truth About Stakeholder Capitalism. And Andy, you begin the book, even before the book begins, with a dedication to Milton Friedman. And I love Milton Friedman, my favorite economist. There's been so much discussion over the past couple of years about whether the Friedman era is over. The Biden administration saying that spending doesn't matter, debts don't matter, modern monetary theory. Have those on the left buried Friedman quite prematurely?
Milton Friedman's theories work. They produce a productive economy where we have prosperity, where wages go up, where inflation is low, where you keep debt under control. Biden and his crew that came in and said that, okay, stakeholder capitalism now, we're not going to do shareholder capitalism. We're not going to do Milton Friedman's version of your obligation is to your shareholders if you're a CEO. We're now going to make it an obligation to all of society.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work. It didn't work in the United States. The Biden economy is, you know, really is a dumpster fire economy funded by incredible debt, unparalleled deficits. And it's an economic approach that failed, and it failed in the former Soviet Union. It failed in Cuba. It failed in Venezuela. It failed in red China until they adopted what they called red capitalism. It wasn't even real capitalism, and it improved things.
Hmm.
So what Friedman said works. You know, free market capitalism is even Barack Obama said free market capitalism has created the greatest wealth in human history and it's lifted billions of people out of poverty. He said that at Georgetown University in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's right, and he is right, why would you mess with a system like that? You know, why would you mess with a system that has lifted billions of people out of poverty and created tremendous wealth? You know, I think the reason is because people like to use the economy and economic philosophies to gain power. And I think that's what happened in the United States under Biden, and it produced terrible economic results.
For our listeners, Andy, a brief definition or comparison between what you talk about in the book as the ugly truth of stakeholder capitalism as compared to shareholder capitalism. How do they differ?
Well, the ugly truth is about stakeholder capitalism is that it isn't capitalism at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rejection of free market capitalism. It's an attempt by a group of financial elites that run the largest asset management firms in the world, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, to impose their social and political beliefs on us you know, they claim to protect us, but really because they don't trust us to make decisions for ourselves, our nation, or our planet. Stakeholder capitalism is really a rejection of free market capitalism. Free market capitalism allows the American people to decide the direction of the economy through their open market purchases. It's also a rejection of democracy, which allows us to vote on whether we adopt social or political policies, that we don't have them imposed on us by a financial elite. Stakeholder capitalism empowers these financial elites to impose their will on us by voting the shares they hold in American companies to, again, advance a woke leftist political and cultural agenda. Now, you might think I'm exaggerating when I say that, but I think if your listeners will think about it for a minute, You probably wondered why so many big American businesses that we've been familiar with throughout our lives, such as have been pursuing policies that just don't make any sense.
Right.
Like, why would Disney and Target, which are supposed to be family friendly brands, or Anheuser-Busch, which is trying to sell beer to beer drinkers, why would they advance a transgender agenda? Or why would ExxonMobil and Chevron adopt net zero carbon emission policies when their business depends for its survival on the production of oil and gas? Well, The reason is because there really is a group of financial elites out there who control huge shareholdings in virtually every U.S. publicly traded company, who vote those shares to advance this political agenda, taking the power away from us as consumers to make those decisions for ourselves and where we want to take the economy, and depriving us of our rights in a democratic system of government to vote on what policies we choose to enact. So with shareholder capitalism, you really have the people making the decisions as to the direction of the economy. But with stakeholder capitalism, they take the shares that they hold, these massive asset management firms, take the shares they hold, by the way, on behalf of others. They hold them on behalf of retirees, primarily people in the working and middle class who have retirement, pension funds, or 401k plans. And then they vote those shares to set the direction for the economy and the direction for our political future, rather than letting us do it ourselves.
You mentioned the big three, and they are referenced all throughout A Tyranny for the Good of Its Victims: BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard. What are they? What do they do? Why do they have so much power?
Oh, they are asset managers. They manage investments for various groups of people, primarily, as I said, pension funds, 401k plans, retirement vehicles. They became very powerful over the last 25, 30 years because they are what's called passive asset managers. Now, when I was young, when you thought about hiring somebody to invest money for you, you would hire what was called an active asset manager. In other words, they would go out and decide which companies they thought were going to be successful, and they would invest in those companies, and then they would track those companies' progress so they knew whether to buy or sell the stock of that company going forward. Now, that was an expensive process because it takes a lot of effort and energy to do the research necessary to track all these companies' financial progress and what they're doing with new products or new management teams. That takes a lot of energy, a lot of effort. So there were fees attached to that kind of investing. A different kind of investing arose out of some people from the University of Chicago called passive investing, where you don't invest in individual companies. You invest in a group of companies. For example, the S&P 500 is a group of 500 of the most successful and largest companies in the United States. You invest in that group on the theory that, you know, you've got 500 very successful companies. They've probably got very good CEOs who are trying to make the companies even more profitable. They probably have good products. They probably have good profitability. They probably have low debt. This is how they got to be a successful company. And if they stop having those things, S&P takes them out of the group of 500 and adds in companies that have become more successful. So you end up with an investment in 500 companies, and you can't sell each companies individually in this index. You own the whole index of companies.
Right.
So it's a very diversified way to invest. It's a way to invest where you don't really have to do all that research. So the fees for this kind of investing are very low. It's a very inexpensive investment. And it turns out over time that it generally produces superior returns, better results than active investors do, because it's very hard to beat the 500 most successful companies in the country.
Right.
So BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard were all passive managers. And over the past 25 years, we actually got to the point last year where there's more money invested in passive asset management funds than there is invested in active funds. So they become very powerful. They now manage, combined, they manage about $21 trillion. That's 80% of our annual GDP in the United States, and it's larger than the GDP of every country in the world other than the United States and China. With that money, they've become the largest shareholders in about 80% of the companies in the S&P 500 and the largest shareholder in thousands of companies, publicly traded companies, in the U.S. economy. So they've gained tremendous power.
We're talking with Andy Puzder. He's the author of the new book, A Tyranny for the Good of Its Victims, The Ugly Truth About Stakeholder Capitalism. More with him next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, friends. RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor, Monte Cristo Classic No. 2. This Figueroa has been described as one of the world's great cigars, a silky Connecticut shade wrapper in combination with the best Dominican tobaccos form this perfectly constructed cigar. The smooth aroma of toasted almonds, vanilla, coffee, and spice round out this classic stick. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Looking for the freshest top-shelf flower? Look no further than the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake, where they work directly with small, local farmers to bring you the finest flower that fits your price. The Queen of Dragons has the best prices on carts, edibles, concentrates, and pre-rolls. Plus, don't miss happy hour every day from 6 p.m. until close and all day Sundays. Don't just stock up on toilet paper. The Queen of Dragons has great deals, so you can stock up on the best flower for the best prices. So what are you waiting for? Stop by Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-238-5638 for details or delivery. That's 530-238-5638. And don't forget to follow Queen of Dragons on Facebook and X at the Queen Dragons for all the latest deals and updates. Support Queen of Dragons, a local business in the city of Shasta Lake, where you will find the most friendly and knowledgeable staff. Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard. Visit queenofdragons.com or follow us on X at the Queen Dragons.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
If you're tired of artificial intelligence and dishonest news, tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday at 8 a.m.
Join Nick Gardner and Doug Janke, two hosts who were educated at the School of Hard Knocks. Get a layman's view of local government as well as our take on national and world events.
If you're woke, go back to bed. You won't like us. We believe there's a difference between a man and a woman, and I think you probably know what it is.
Tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday, 8 a.m. here on KCNR1460.com, 96.5 FM, and 1460 AM.
Get ready to celebrate love and style with KCNR. Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and KCNR is here to make your celebration unforgettable. Tune in each weekday from 7 to 9 a.m. for your chance to participate in our Love Song Challenge. We'll play a clip of a famous love song, and if you can name it, call 530-605-4566, and you'll be entered into our drawing to win a Valentine's Day grand prize package to be given away Monday, February 3rd at 8:10 a.m. during Free Fire Radio with Carl and Linda Bott. The Valentine's Day prize package includes a $100 gift certificate to Taroko Asian Bar and Grill at 1701 Pine Street in downtown Reading for a delicious Valentine's Day dinner with music from Pat Karch on piano. The Valentine's Day prize package also includes a dozen stunning long-stem red roses valued at $146, courtesy of Reading Florist at 3260 Bocelli Lane. Visit them online at readingflorist@charter.net. Also included, 2 dozen premium chocolate truffles from Bouquet Bon Appetit at bouquetbonappetit@gmail.com. Also included in the Valentine's Day prize package, 2 tickets to Chocolate After Dark at the Turtle Bay Museum on Friday, February 7th at 6 p.m. Must be 21 and older to attend. KCNR is partnered with Taroko Asian Bar and Grill, Redding Florist, Bouquet Bon Appetit, and the Turtle Bay Museum to bring you this dreamy Valentine's Day prize package on KCNR.
We're talking with Andy Puzder. He's the author of the new book, A Tyranny for the Good of Its Victims, The Ugly Truth About Stakeholder Capitalism. More with him next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. You mentioned this activism of those companies and ESG investors. One of the ideas, or one of the things that is discussed, is forced board diversity for companies. In Illinois a few years ago, there was a bill proposed that would have forced companies to have one woman, one African-American, one Latino on the board of directors. They watered that down a bit so that the companies in Illinois just have to list their board by sexual orientation, by race, by ethnicity. Forced board diversity, what's bad about that for business and for profitability and for the economy?
Well, first of all, from a moral perspective, since at least 1964, we've been working at, which was passage of the Civil Rights Act, when we made discriminating against people based upon their race or their sex illegal. We have specifically tried to move towards a society where people are judged on their qualifications, merit, and character. If you call Martin Luther King and his very famous I Have a Dream speech in the early 1960s, said that he looked forward to the day when his children would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. We've been moving towards that for many, many years. But if you have a requirement that you have to put people on your board of directors because of their race or because of their sex, then you've really backed away from, we're going to just put people on the board, or we're going to hire people based upon who they are as opposed to what they are. And that can be very bad for businesses, because businesses really should put on their boards of directors the most qualified people, whether they're black, white, red, yellow, whether they're male or female. You should put the most qualified people on your board of directors. When you require that people put people on your board because of their race or their sex, in other words, when you discriminate based upon race or sex, then you're really saying you may be putting people on who aren't the most qualified. So what that would do is it would favor companies that already had a very competent board of directors. Mm-hmm. If you have a lot of very experienced and competent people on your board, it may not hurt you to add a couple people who are less qualified. However, if you're a company that does not have a very good board and you want to increase the quality of the board members that you have with respect to their experience in the business that you're trying to run, if you're required to hire people for requirements other than their qualifications, their merits, then you're going to end up with a board that really is not very effective in running the business. And this is the board really decides who the CEO is. They have ultimate control over the direction of the company from a very macro respect. Mm-hmm. So it can be very damaging to your company.
Andy Puzder with us. His new book, A Tyranny for the Good of Its Victims, The Ugly Truth About Stakeholder Capitalism, the Profit Motive. This is a Friedman maxim that you focus on in the book, too. The actual power of capitalism lies in the profit motive. Why is the profit motive more productive, a better incentive than, say, ESG? Why does it lead to benefits for not just the wealthy, but also the poor in the country?
Well, you know, the only way you succeed in a capitalist economy is by meeting the needs of other people. In other words, you have to satisfy your consumers, your customers' needs, or your business doesn't succeed. So what you have is you have literally millions of people here in the United States striving every day to try and meet the needs of other people. This is why we have grocery stores that are full of food. This is why we have iPhones. This is why we have, you know, cars that were mass manufactured. You know, Henry Ford set it up so even people that weren't rich could afford to drive cars. This is why we have Teslas. This is why we have Elon Musk and Steve Jobs and people like Henry Ford, who really tried to advance their own interests, in other words, to make a profit so that they could benefit themselves. But they realized that to do that, they had to benefit other people. So while we do have very wealthy people in this country, and I hear a lot of complaints about oligarchs, but leaving that aside for a minute, Jeff Bezos, who created Amazon, and Elon Musk, who's got runs like six companies now, these people didn't become, they became tremendously wealthy, but they didn't become tremendously wealthy by stealing from us. They became tremendously wealthy because they provided us with tremendous benefits. And that profit motive is so important because what, you know, you've heard, people have probably heard the saying on the left where they say, well, you can do well economically. You can do well by doing good socially. You can do well by doing good. That's the theory behind stakeholder capitalism and ESG. The point they're missing is you can't do anybody any good unless you do well first. In other words, you have to have a profitable company to benefit people, to create the products that people want, to create the jobs that people need, to create business for your suppliers, and to create largesse for your communities. You really have to do well before you can do any good. Now, there's nothing wrong with doing good. So it is very important. The profit motive is very important. It's a recognition of human nature, the idea that you want to improve your life and the life of your family. And it harnesses that to improving the lives of society and other people in general.
Andy Pozdur with us, his new book, A Tyranny for the Good of Its Victims. We recently saw, Andy, a ruling by a judge against American Airlines and their ESG investing strategy that said it violated federal law. Does that strike a big blow against the entire concept of ESG for many of these companies in the country?
Yeah, that's huge. And I think it'll be upheld on appeal. The court was looking at a federal law. It's called the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA. And ERISA says that when you are investing money for people that have investments in private pension plans, you have to invest solely and exclusively in their interest and to generate returns from them. Now, it was passed back in the 1970s because people were concerned about the Teamsters. The Teamsters were investing in casinos in Las Vegas. And even though those turned out to be pretty darn good investments, you know, in retrospect, at the time it looked like they were investing with gangsters and doing things that, you know, maybe weren't in the best interest of the Teamsters themselves. So they passed this federal law requiring this sole and exclusive focus on the people on whose behalf you're investing and maximizing their returns. Well, you can't maximize returns for your investors if you're instructing the companies in which you invest their monies to pursue these environmental, social, and justice obligations, which diminish the profitability of the company. In other words, you can't be maximizing returns when you're encouraging the companies to do things that diminish their returns. And so the court in Texas said, look, what BlackRock did and what the trustees did in hiring BlackRock violated the provisions of ERISA, which are very, very clear, and they could potentially be held liable. Now, I think the Court of Appeals, that's in the Fifth Circuit, I think they will uphold that.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully the Supreme Court will uphold it because the language of the statute is very clear that you have to act solely and exclusively in the best interest of your clients, of your investors.
Andy Pozdur is an author, speaker, and political commentator. He's also a retired CEO of CKE Restaurants and a distinguished fellow at the Heritage Foundation. His brand new book, A Tyranny for the Good of Its Victims, The Ugly Truth About Stakeholder Capitalism. Andy, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It was my pleasure. Hillsdale is such a great place. I always love doing things with you guys, so thank you very much for having me.
Up next, Pat Bart joins us from Hillsdale's English Department as we conclude our in-depth series into the history of the English language. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Reading Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history. It is with great honor and pride that we have been able to support several amazing local businesses like these over the years.
Thanks to the Reading Rancheria for their support of the Kiwanis Festive Dam Club Food for Kids program. We send 185 bags of food home every Friday. They're instrumental in helping us.
Reading Rancheria, proud to play our part.
Valentine's Day isn't just for sweethearts anymore. So if you're looking for a unique gift idea, stop by Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles at 1773 Highway 273 in the Shasta Gateway Center in Anderson. They have a wide selection of great gift ideas, including antique and costume jewelry, vintage rings, necklaces, bracelets, brooches, and even cufflinks. They also offer antique toys and vintage dolls, antique rugs and blankets, curtains, tablecloths, embroidered linen, furniture and china, silverware and clocks, books, and a whole lot of movies, along with collectibles, including sports memorabilia and a wide assortment of glass and artwork, kitchenware, and vintage clothing. Memory Lane is open Monday, 10 to 6, closed Tuesday and Wednesday, open Thursday through Saturday from 10 to 6, and Sunday, noon to 5. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles at 1773 Highway 273 in Anderson in the Shasta Gateway Center.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. She had minor damage to her rear bumper. I wrote her an estimate. Later, I received a call. The lady responsible for the damage wanted to pay for the repairs out of pocket. Her insurance agent told her a claim would raise her rates for years. With our experience in the claim process, I explained to her most insurance companies would forgive a claim if the cost was below a minimum amount. I suggested she contact her insurance agent and have them review her policy. She called back very excited. It appeared her policy did extend forgiveness. They would pay for the repairs and she wouldn't be charged with a claim or have to pay a deductible. The accident would not cost her a thing. She was very pleased. Good thing the vehicle owner came to the right place for repairs. We all pay a lot for insurance. Choosing Coachmaster will ensure you get the most for your money. Let this experience work for you. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
Thank you, Redding Rancheria, for supporting Tree of Life International Charter School. Gracias por todo su apoyo.
Thank you, Redding Rancheria!
The Shasta Lake Chamber of Commerce wants to thank the Redding Rancheria. They have sponsored our Friday night in the park for more than 18 years, and we really appreciate it.
Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. We continue and, in fact, conclude our in-depth series on the history of the English language today with Dr. Pat Bart, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. This is the final portion of our conversation. You can find previous chapters by heading to podcast.hillsdale.edu and looking at past episodes. Dr. Bart, into the 1500s and the 1600s, we have Shakespeare, pretty important guy. How does the printing press, how does increased literacy and popular writers like Shakespeare end up changing the language?
Okay, well, that's several topics. Let's just talk about the printing aspect of this. Caxton in the 15th century, right? So right around the time when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, right? He set up a printing business first in Bruges, but then later moved back to England. He first published his own English translation of a French romance about the history of Troy. So ancient Mediterranean stories still had a lot of prestige, and apparently not just prestige, but saleability,
mm-hmm.
right? Because this guy, Caxton, I mean, he needs to earn a living from this. He needs to make money from this. So, you know, he's only taking risks on things he thinks are saleable, right? So maybe it's sort of like those movies about ancient times in the 50s. You know, those were very saleable, I guess, at the time, right? So Caxton, you know, has that sense that these will be saleable, and they are. Okay. He seems to have known that there was a large enough reading public for English texts that he should translate this text, this, you know, pretty prestigious text, he should translate it into English rather than just printing it in French. Okay, so there you go. Okay, so by that time, no, I don't want to read a French copy. It's easier to read this English copy, you know. And so that again shows, just like Henry V using English as a diplomatic language, mm-hmm. Caxton is using it as a literary language, a language in which you might buy a copy of an august text about the fall of Troy, right? So about 15 years after Thomas Malory had completed an English translation of the French Morte d'Arthur, which we call by the French name, right, to this day, then Caxton, he was approached, as he himself reports, by many noble and diverse gentlemen of England, I quote, who came and demanded of me, and oftentimes, wherefore that I had not made and imprinted the noble history of the Sainte Graal. The Holy Grail, right? And of the most renowned Christian king, Arthur, which ought most to be remembered among us English men before all other Christian kings. Okay. He depicts, this is from his preface to the Morte d'Arthur that he published. He depicts, like, he actually sort of depicts a popular demand for this work by various gentlemen mm-hmm. repeatedly asking him, why haven't you published something about King Arthur? So this invoked his still popular 1485 print edition of Malory's work, which he typeset, and it's kind of interesting. At this time in history, the 15th century, Gutenberg does this too. He typeset it to look like the handwriting of his day. The development of the kind of clean-looking type that we have now comes much later and wasn't considered desirable.
Sure.
Because what you wanted was the real thing,
mm-hmm.
and the real thing was handwritten, right? So then there's an explosion of printing, relative then to an explosion of English literacy, which essentially is to support business and government, right? Government record keeping, business record keeping, various kinds of communications, right?
Dr. Bart, when you say an explosion of literacy, what exactly does that mean? Are we talking certainly not universal literacy, but what do you mean?
It's gone from maybe 1%, you know, to like 30% or something. I don't know the exact percentages, but it's still, it's an explosion mm-hmm. compared to what there had been before, right? And much further into sort of the, what we would call upper middle class, not just nobles, not just clergymen, right? So you can see English like regaining force at this, because of this readership, it regains force as a language of letters. You see that starting with Chaucer writing tales for edification and enjoyment in English, though he clearly read French and Latin, and he actually translated from French and Latin as well. Malory, you see translating into English, the French prose. So you see this building kind of readership in English throughout those couple of generations, until finally you see Caxton and his entrepreneurial spirit, you know, eyeing that sizable market mm-hmm. for his publications. Now, Shakespeare, his works are not officially printed in his own time. And this is in part to avoid piracy. You've got the bad quartos, as early scholars of Shakespeare's texts called them, that are clearly pirated. They seem to be copied down from memory. One of them, you know, Hamlet, it's horrific. It's just to be or not to be. That's the thing. I don't know. You're just like, oh, wow, it's just going down from here, I bet, you know. So here we see an early attempt to protect intellectual property,
mm-hmm.
which is not really known in the same way in the Middle Ages. Now, you know, if somebody attributed a work by Gentleman X to Gentleman Y, people might have gotten huffy, but you didn't see these moves to like protect your stuff, right? You know, as much as you see it here.
Dr. Pat Bart with us. Dr. Bart, how did Shakespeare incorporate history and language into his plays and other works?
There's kind of a fun tie-in with this whole relationship between French and English in Shakespeare's England. In Henry V, Act 2, Scene 4, there is a scene that is entirely in French. And I'll give you a little bit of it. We have Alice, tu as été en Angleterre et tu parles bien le langage. Un peu, madame. You know, so she says, Alice, Catherine says, the princess says, Alice, you've been in England and you speak the language well. And Alice says, oh, a little bit, madame. The way I always say about my French. Oh, you speak French? Un petit peu. Yeah, maybe not. But the scene involves Catherine, the Princess Royal of France, and her lady-in-waiting Alice, who has spent some time in England, knows the language well. She informs Catherine that les doigts, appelons, the fingers are called de fingres, right? Okay. And le clude is delbo, which Catherine gets completely wrong, and she calls it the bilbo, right? And Alice then opines that, yeah, maybe the language is trop difficile. Maybe it's a little bit too difficult, right? Because of the body language, even if you don't speak any French, you kind of get what's going on, and you hear things like they're waving their fingers and going, de fingres, you know, and oh, the fingers. Oh, yeah, wow, that's like a ridiculous French-accented fingers, right? Like the knights in Monty Python, right, and the Holy Grail, right. Right? We already got one, you know. So it's that kind of scene. It really shows that Shakespeare knew he had important people in his audience who would have been forced to learn French as kids. And seeing a princess royal of the French trying to learn English and finding that hard,
mm-hmm.
would be very gratifying to like, oh, she has to learn English. Oh, and it's like equally hard. Okay, well, serves you right, right? And we have to remember, there are no subtitles
right.
at this point. There's no, like at the opera, you know, they don't have the words up there on a screen, right? So we, you know, that was apparently he didn't think that was much of a risk. You know, he thought that would, this is gonna work, right? So there you see, it's sort of come full circle, the relationship between French and English at that point, where clearly you still have enough people in England speaking French. I mean, to this very day,
mm-hmm.
there are jokey, like, let's parler franglais, right? Where people speak sort of like it's not really French and it's not really English. And yet the power situation has completely flipped at that point.
We will finish up with Dr. Pat Bart in just a moment as we conclude our series on the history of the English language. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Considering the purchase of an e-bike, why not get more bang for your buck? Reading Electric Utilities e-bike program offers $1,000 towards an e-bike and $150 towards a lock and helmet for income-eligible applicants. With gas and car prices on the rise, there's no better time to take advantage of the new cycling connections in Reading. Join the movement to save some green while going green. E-biking means more fun, more trails for your tires, and more smiles per mile. Find out if you qualify at cityofreading.org/rebates.
Valentine's Day isn't just for sweethearts anymore. So if you're looking for a unique gift idea, stop by Memory Lane Antiques Vintage and Collectibles at 1773 Highway 273 in the Shasta Gateway Center in Anderson. They have a wide selection of great gift ideas, including antique and costume jewelry, vintage rings, necklaces, bracelets, brooches, and even cufflinks. They also offer antique toys and vintage dolls, antique rugs and blankets, curtains, tablecloths, embroidered linens, furniture and china, silverware and clocks, books, and a whole lot of movies, along with collectibles, including sports memorabilia and a wide assortment of glass and artwork, kitchenware, and vintage clothing. Memory Lane is open Monday, 10 to 6, closed Tuesday and Wednesday, open Thursday through Saturday from 10 to 6, and Sunday, noon to 5. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles at 1773 Highway 273 in Anderson in the Shasta Gateway Center.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
John Cruz here with America Outdoors Radio. Be sure to tune in this weekend and catch the latest in fishing, hunting, conservation, and destinations. If you love spending time in the field or on the water or in the woods, you're going to love this show. It's America Outdoors Radio, the fastest growing outdoors radio show in the nation. Tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio.
The Ramsey Show.
You actually can help people, and you don't help them by giving them a government program. You help them by showing them the way out. People love me enough to put their arm around me and show me a different way. I didn't figure it all out in my own head. So there's a power to hope, but that's not some kind of false panacea positive thinking way. It works. You can't positive think your way into everything, but you can't negative think your way into anything.
Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We say hello and welcome to our brand new radio affiliate, Talk Radio 92.3 and AM 760 WETR, Knoxville's Talk You Can Trust. Thank you for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We continue our conversation and conclude our conversation with Dr. Pat Bart from Hillsdale's English Department on the history of the English language. Dr. Bart, we march on into the 18th century to talk about Milton, another famous author, and the regularization of the English language.
Okay, so by the 17th century, you know, Milton, he's, you know, after Shakespeare, Milton comes along. The English language, the spelling system, the orthographical system in technical terms, it has kind of settled down to pretty close to what we would do. But here's something quite interesting, and this is related to the printing industry. Surviving copies of a writer's work by the time of Milton, even in his own time, are mostly printed copies. Okay. The sole surviving copy in manuscript of Paradise Lost is a single fair copy, which is like, it's not even like the sort of the scratchy copy, you know, that you're working on. It's a fair copy, probably, you know, one taken to a printer, right, of only book one. Only book one survives in manuscript, and it's the Pierpont Morgan Library. Okay. It's definitely not Milton's handwriting. He was completely blind by that time, so it's one of his amanuenses, right? But despite the fact that this is considered by Milton to be one of his, you know, great works, right, he entrusted its posterity to print editions. So really, at this point, we can talk about authorial publication. Okay, so you write something expecting to publish it. You hand it off to someone else who's going to make huge numbers of multiple copies, right, and then sell it to the public, right? That's in Milton's time. Now, if you think backwards, in Shakespeare's time and in Caxton's time, I mean, that's at a nascent stage in Shakespeare's time. I mean, in Caxton's time, you might call it more like duplication, because a lot of the authors that Caxton prints are already dead, right? And he just picks them up and prints them and sort of duplicates, right? You could say that that's publication because he's the publisher deliberately selling to the public, sure. but it's not authorial publication, right? Because Mallory, sitting around in house arrest writing his translation, is not thinking, yeah, and I'm going to get this Caxton guy. But he died before that happened, right? So, and then if we go back to Chaucer's time, it's really more appropriately referred to as circulation.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I start writing something, I get all excited, I go down to the pub with my friends, I read it aloud, some of them want copies, I give it to their secretary because, like, I got a copy back at home that I keep working on
mm-hmm.
and changing. Okay, but meanwhile, they can make a copy. So that's really more like the medieval kind of publication, if you will. Very different. Okay. There is an example. Virgil was actually published by Maecenas and Augustus. Okay, but they wanted to get that out there into the public, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's rare. That's extremely rare earlier than this print era, right?
As we talk more about the standardization of language, we are introduced to a man named Samuel Johnson and the idea of the dictionary.
Yes, well, Johnson's dictionary was quite the tome, 1,600 and some pages. No one publisher could actually afford to publish it at the time. No, I mean, really, you know, a sort of consortium of people got together to propose this thing to him. He had been concerned that the English language was just getting crazy out of hand. Now, he's not the kind of, I don't know, Samuel Johnson is anything but a kind of schoolmarmish person. He didn't want to control everybody or something like that. He's sometimes presented that way recently in the scholarship, but he was concerned that people were just using English in a sloppy way, and then this was getting into print. Okay, so see now, you know, it used to be, you don't have to worry about that.
Right.
Nobody is ever going to be copied unless they're top drawer anyway, right? Because who's going to bother? It's such a pain.
Mm-hmm.
It's so expensive. Well, now it's getting to be so cheap that everybody is getting on the internet and publishing themselves, right? Okay, I mean, it's only gotten worse, right?
That's right. Yep.
So, you know, Johnson is just, he's like, yeah, I'm ready for it. I'll do it, right? So he takes quite a bit of time. Collects people's opinions about what a word means or the proper usage of words, adjudicates amongst these opinions. He also is at pains to get attestation of the use of words from context, okay, and usually in printed form, right? And so he develops his dictionary that way, and its audience is a sort of a whole new group of people who are, say, businessmen who want to write letters and not look like rubes, you know, or like I don't know English or something.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of like this new sense of like, I want to present myself in print. Well, like already, you know, how many people ever in the history of mankind presented themselves in print before this era of the 18th century, right? Not too many.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they didn't have to worry about how they expressed themselves, because if they were who they were, they expressed themselves and they defined the language, right? Well, now it's not so. There are people who are a little angsty about, I've learned a lot of things, but I just don't think I use words the right way sometimes. And can I look that up? Now, of course, the regularization of the orthography of the spelling is necessary if you're going to do a dictionary, because how do you look things up?
Right.
And those of us who are literary scholars, when we look things up in the Middle English Dictionary, it's horrific because there's all these spelling variants, right? And it's just crazy making. So this age of reason, if you will, in part, led to an age of regularization, which then made it possible to have things like dictionaries in the first place. Now, in the 19th century, of course, James Murray's Oxford English Dictionary, you know, since this had become a concept, there had been English dictionaries before Johnson, but they were very brief. And then Johnson's with this, you know, really ambitious work. And then you get people at Oxford, such as James Murray, and he's like, I can see you and raise you. You know, I'm going to make this even more ambitious and show you the whole historical trajectory of a given word by attestation across time. And of course, that's ongoing.
Right.
It's still ongoing, and it's electronic now.
Yeah.
It's fully electronic and really highly, wonderfully highly searchable. So
how should we close this? Because as you mentioned, it is ongoing. Right. The language is ongoing.
The language is ongoing. The study of it's ongoing.
Yes.
We haven't even covered a tenth of the topics we might have.
That's right. We picked and choose. How do we want to close our conversation?
Well, you know, all this keeps me off the streets, I just have to say. But, well, regularization very importantly plays into the development of computing. I mean, there are other aspects of mathematical study that also play into it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But large language models of today, you know, if they're, you could run a large language model in Middle English, but wow, that would be crazier than if you have regularized texts for it to kind of play around with.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Jonathan Swift, actually, in Gulliver's Travels, travels to this place called Logado, and there's this academy of projectors, and they have an engine where the head of the academy and his students sit about this machine. It's a square, and there's a bunch of words on the machine, and they turn cranks, and they just like avidly, they just, you know, crazy fast turn the cranks, and then they stop, and then it tells them things, and it gives them wisdom, right? And, you know, I mean, hey, what are large language models doing, you know?
Right.
I mean, ChatGPT. So I think that's where we end, right? Where we end by my inviting myself back to talk about large language models or whatever,
all right.
Right? About all of these other topics that we haven't yet covered.
Topic for a different time and a book for a different time as well. Dr. Pat Bart, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College, as we talk about the history of the English language. Dr. Bart, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so much, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Andy Puzder, author of A Tyranny for the Good of Its Victims, and Dr. Pat Bart as we conclude our investigation into the history of the English language. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Get ready to explore the expansive universe of aviation and cutting-edge space technology in Turtle Bay's newest exhibition, Mission Aerospace, presented by Dr. Eric and Tiffany Blassingame and produced by Minotaur Mazes, on display at Turtle Bay Museum January 18th through April 20th. This highly interactive maze puzzle is sure to inspire all generations. Mission Aerospace at Turtle Bay Museum is free for members and included with paid admission. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. 27 years ago, my wife Judy and I started Shasta Gas with the help and under the direction of the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, we believe He is the owner and we are simply the managers. Through the years, we have received many offers from major national corporations to buy Shasta Gas, but our commitment has always been to be and remain locally owned and family operated. Our daughter Karen Wehunt and her husband Jason now manage the daily operations of Shasta Gas and Shasta Tanks, a new business we started a few years ago. We now have the third generation of family members working in the business. Sunshine Stevens, our granddaughter, and her husband Adam, and our grandson Jason. Our commitment and motto are still the same. Our customers are warm friends. To support locally owned family operated business, please call Shasta Gas Propane at 530-365-3793. That's 530-365-3793.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor, Monte Cristo Classic No. 2. This Figueroa has been described as one of the world's great cigars, a silky Connecticut shade wrapper in combination with the best Dominican tobaccos form this perfectly constructed cigar. The smooth aroma of toasted almonds, vanilla, coffee, and spice round out this classic stick. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Summer musical auditions are coming up at Shasta College. Come audition for our 2025 musical production of Guys and Dolls. Auditions will take place on March 10th, 2025 at 6 p.m. in the Shasta College Theater Building 500 and are open to students and the community of all ages. Ensemble members are still needed. Rehearsals will begin June 9th, 2025, and a detailed schedule will be provided to those cast. Contact Dr. Greg Thorson for more details.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor, Monte Cristo Classic Number 2. This Figueroa has been described as one of the world's great cigars, a silky Connecticut shade wrapper in combination with the best Dominican tobaccos form this perfectly constructed cigar. The smooth aroma of toasted almonds, vanilla, coffee, and spice round out this classic stick. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Redding by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.